So I'm probably also in the same boat as Jennifer is, that I'm not an oral historian by profession, by training. But back in 2000, when I started working with indigenous healers from South Asia, I realized this question that my advisors told me that go and collect some oral histories about traditional medicine from indigenous healers. So I started working with a small group of healers. Most of them were illiterate in a small, remote, isolated tribal village. Entirely indigenous populations. Nobody would speak any single word of other languages than their own. And they wouldn't speak to me for 2 months. I learned the language, local language, which is called Arni language. And when I learned the language and then I started conversing with them, nobody responded for 2 months. I got a short scholarship as a doctoral student, so I almost packed my bags. I called my advisor back in University of Manitoba. I said, I'm coming back. Nobody's responding. I think we started with a nice conception of this traditional medicine idea of research project, working with indigenous healers, but nobody's talking to me. So he said, well, just wait for patients, because oral history is all about, you know, working in patients and having lots of patients. I was a poor grad student, you know, my money was running out. And I said, I'm losing my patience. I packed my bag, I decided to come back next morning. And what happened is that around 4 a.m., the bunch of healers came to me. They woke me up. They said, come with us. I said, okay. We went to the forest, very thick, deep forest. No powers, no lights. They asked me to walk barefoot, so no shoes, nothing. This is a semi-tropical area, so lots of snakes, 3 poisonous snakes. Out of 6 most poisonous snakes, great viper and king cobra were found in this forest. And I said, okay, I'll come with you. You know, I went with them. They, you know, set up a fire with some woods, and they gave me a big pipe to smoke, and they gave me some drink, which we were passing around. We sat in a circle. It was some ceremony. They were chanting in the language. Some of the stuff I could understand. And then they gave me something to drink, and I drank that potion that they gave me, which was made from 32 different plants found in the local forest. As soon as I drank that, I lost my senses for 72 hours. I don't know what happened to me. When I woke up in a small hut surrounded by those bunch of healers. They were laughing at me. They said, now I'm initiated. Ask me what is your questions. What are your questions? What do you want to find out? That's how my oral history actually journey started. And the first question I asked to myself that night is, oral history for whom? Oral history for whom? Oral history for academics, oral history for people, and same question as yours. You know, oral history for people, and that's why I started my journey. So please forgive me if I'm not an oral historian, but what I'm going to share is some of those experiences that I think are shaping me. Okay, where is the thing? Shaping me is an oral history. So I started working with a few communities in different parts. This is how my journey with oral history started. And something at back of my mind after 5 years of working with those healers is that oral history for people, oral history for community, in the shape, in the form, in the structure, in the outcome that they would like to see. And that's how I shaped my different research project then. So first project I looked at is I strongly believe that the indigenous knowledge systems has a very valid body of knowledge systems, and there is a systematic disciplines developed in sciences. There's all kind of ethno-disciplines developed, right from ethnobotanical stuff, ethno-pharmacology, ethnozoology, ethnomusicology, ethno-entomology. And I thought, well, all these people are talking about indigenous knowledge systems. What is it? Is indigenous knowledge systems can provide us an entry point to really start a community-based oral history project. And I think this is how I started my journey with. And I realized that it really challenged the dominant Western way of doing social science-based classical research, where you go and conduct interviews rather than asking people how they want their oral history to be documented. We often think that we go with these electronic gadgets and document and they like it. In fact, I found in my own cases, in many South Asian communities, that as soon as you start using those digital gadgets, they feel intimidated. They have never seen those gadgets in their lives. And I think I found that this is, in fact, those gadgets are becoming obstructions in documenting right oral history, which is coming from people's heart. So I was very much interested in listening to stories, what people want to share. So I then developed a program, and I, in fact, got a grant, big grant. I always wanted some big grant in the past, and this grant enabled me to guide some of the student research in doing some oral history-based research. So one of the ways I do oral history project with the community is through my own research that I'll share in a bit, but also through student research. And lately, in the last 2 years back, I started courses. I thought oral history is not just cannot be taught and documented and stored through research, but there is also by through teachings. So I started developing courses which really encourage and students to talk to the elders, talk to the people who are indigenous knowledge experts, and then really that's why we can document oral history and generate a lot of interest in students. So this is how I started my journey. As you can see, I have several projects to talk about, and we only have 15 minutes. So I'm not going to talk about each and every projects in detail, but this will give you an idea, a snapshot of kind of projects I talk about. Most of the projects, research projects, have become programs where community have really, you know, said, well, this is nice thing, you know. Even we didn't know that this is something to be very useful. So we would like to continue on. So I think that's what is most important. I think, to me, most effective oral history projects are those where community feel the need to sustain it after the formal project is over. I think that's where the bottom line is. And this is how I'm going to share you some stories from the field. So you see, they happen in different parts of the world, including one in Canada, in Fisher River Cree Nations. So I'll talk about that. And what I found is one of the things I wanted to share the story from South India, where I started this oral history project. We wanted to revive certain traditional foods in the culture. And why? Because those foods, especially millets, if you have heard those ancient grains, millets, are disappearing. And we found that these are the miraculous grain. From the science, there is an increasing evidence that millets have highest concentrations of proteins, iron. And they have been used by many indigenous groups in South Asia, Africa, Latin America, also in Canada. Lately, we discovered that. Where indigenous groups have been using those millets to really sustain themselves. They're very healthy grains, but we lost them sometime in 1960s when the Green Revolution came and everything became mechanized and fertilizers were introduced, high yielding varieties were introduced. We wanted to revitalize those traditions. And we said, do you think the millets are important? And why we should conserve them and why we are losing them? So what we did is we asked community that we would like to depict when did you think the millet really disappeared? So basically documenting the oral history of millets and associated knowledges. And the only thing that they knew is they have never used any camera. So we thought we will train the community in operating those Polaroid one-time disposable camera, one-time use cameras. So we bought some cameras, we gave them, and we just gave them very broad question. We just told them that where you go to village, you go to your farms, and take pictures, snaps, wherever you think depict your oral history of the millets. We didn't give any prescription. We just let them like that. And two of our results, you know, it was very, very surprising and very, very, very systematic documentation of oral history knowledge of traditional millets that we documented. And most of them were pictures. And then we collected those pictures. We sat with the community, and then we asked further questions. And then they gave us lots of stories. So these are not systematically oral history documents, but stories collected through pictures and people narratives, mostly in their own languages. I have not been able to translate those things yet. They are still sitting in my office, But we left one photocopy with everything, the community itself. But this is a project that I wanted to talk to you about. The other idea I have seen over these different projects is the intergenerational transmission of knowledge. By my working with different communities, around 12 different indigenous communities in the world, two from Canada, I realized that all the elders are saying that younger people are not interested. Whether it's a traditional crop, traditional medicine, they are not interested in indigenous ways of knowing. And how do we then create opportunity for younger people? Because they are the ones who are going to be future custodians of oral history. How do we keep their interest alive? So we did something, some ideas, and I just wanted to share one idea about this booklet that I talked about. This is a project we started in the Fisher River. It's a Cree syllable, if you see. This is a traditional recipe from Fisher River. It says Forgotten Foods of Fisher River. This has around 77 recipes. And this is a 2 years project where four people from University of Winnipeg were involved, including three graduate students, undergraduate students. And they were documenting, they were talking to elders and collecting those recipes and trying to find out where are those recipes, first thing, why we are losing them, and how can we revive them? Three basic questions. So all my research projects always start with these three very simple basic questions. What is the indigenous knowledge surrounding the whatever natural resource you are using, whether it's a food, medicine, agriculture, anything? Why? What are the challenges? Why we are losing it? Why younger people are not interested? And third, how do we revitalize this? So I'm going to pass this around. This is a work of 2 years. And each document 77 recipes from the elders. And I waited 1 year for elders to give me a permission. I wanted to launch this at UFW because I thought I would be famous, you know, as a prof. I did this work. The elders didn't let me to. They said, first we will have a community launch. So, and every time we started a journey to go to community, something must have happened there. And the elders told me the spirits are not yet ready. So we waited for 2 years, but finally it was launched last year at Fisher River in a community over a feast. So I think, and they invited school children. They invited the Charles Sinclair School. And then school children found it very interesting. They said, wow, those are amazing recipes. We never knew that, you know, where our oral traditions are so rich and diverse. And I think this is where, I think to me, oral history means. Unless we really, you know, engage creatively the younger people who are going to be users of oral history, to me, this is what oral history is all about. I don't know about any stuff about digitization. I don't know. I'm not an oral historian. But what I do is to revive oral history of communities and ask them and request them that what is the best way to conserve this oral history for the future generations. So this is a project that we did. Another project I did through in Kisikoven in First Nations near Riding Mountain National Park. And this is about traditional medicine. And what I do is I take around 10 to 12 students every year there, and we camp out there for 1 week, and we connect them with elders. So it's actually oral history in action. So rather than talking about oral history as a method, and I did publish a couple of papers on oral history, though, with SAGE. But that apart, like, this is a book where they talk to elders. There are two elders who are very knowledgeable and willing to share their knowledge. And they collect traditional knowledge of about 60 medicinal plants. And then I said, okay, let's now document the oral history from other indigenous groups that you find from archival research. So they do the both. So this is actually a collection of existing indigenous knowledges about medicinal plant as well as oral history, a synthesis of both. And this is also, I'm going to pass it around. And students work around 60 plants. Every year they go there, they talk to elders, and they document these plants and talk about those plants. So I think to me, I'm not going to read what I'm going to present, but I'm rather going to tell something from my heart, which is I'm going to share some stories that I've been doing. I think what is important is these oral historical traditions about traditional food. I think this is really in danger. So far, with my work with 10 to 12 different communities, indigenous communities in the world, including two from Canada, the picture is not, very hopeful. Picture is not very silver. Picture is very bleak. Elders are concerned that the traditional foods, we are losing it. And most serious concern is not the loss of traditional foods. Most serious concerns is loss of knowledges associated with traditional food and the respect towards those knowledges. What is being taught in university is all right, but what makes people alive and kicking and vibrant in their own culture and community? I think oral historians for us, to me, is a more important job to do there rather than doing work in academics. So I'll just stop there. I think I have lots to share. I have so many stories to share. But I'll stop there, and I'll rather take the questions. These are some of the quotes that I took from the interviews with the millet farmers. And they're realizing the values of some of the traditional grains, traditional millets, traditional food. But I think with the advent of green revolution, as I said, with the advent of rice, as we eat rice, in one case we documented 70 traditional varieties of rice. None of them we use anywhere in the world, except in that part. Some of the millet varieties have really disappeared. And food is a medicine. This is another biggest lesson to me, actually, from oral history. It never occurred. I think as a modern consumers, we always compartmentalize our food. This is our food is for healthy people. Medicine is for sick people. But in many cultures, food is always a medicine. So if you eat proper food, you don't have to be sick, and then you don't have to be then consuming medicine. So this is another very, very biggest sort of theme that emerged from my short research. As I said, certain crops have been completely lost. So we started some activities at UFW2. We started with indigenous food sovereignty workshops. I think the term is food sovereignty and not food security. Food security is more like a government concepts. You measure lots of numbers, but most important is people should have right to what they would like to consume and what they like to produce. People should have a free right to food consumption and their own methods of food production. And that's what I think we should be striving for. And that's the only way to really revitalize indigenous foods, but also associated knowledge systems. And in Fisher River, actually, they were saying this. They were telling that there was no diabetes. Now, everybody's talking about, from the health sciences in Canada, everybody's so concerned about type 2 diabetes in First Nations communities, right? There is big, really, it is a serious issue coming from health science sector. But these elders told us when we were trying to document their oral history, they said there was no diabetes before 60 years in Fisher River, not a single incident, 60 years, 70 years, because they were all eating healthy foods, some of the foods that you see in those books. So what really happened there? So very, very important insights one could generate from oral history in terms of providing directions to research in other sectors. Foods eaten in the past, we made some tables about foods eaten in the past and foods eaten today. And you see this transition happen in last 70, 80 years, where you would see that most of the land-based foods that were eaten in the past are gone now. So what you eat is mostly foods which are coming from your food store, which is not always land-based. Food is actually a way of life for many people there. Food is not just something to be consumed. It's also a way of life. And that is also a very, very dominant theme that we found. Some of the crops we lost in the world forever, like this crop you see, very, very important crop. Incidentally, last year I was invited at the annual Canadian Food and Nutrition Conference. I told them that I'm not a food and nutritionist. But they said, no, you are doing some interesting work, so come and share your ideas. I shared this plant, and they said, the city of Saskatoon is getting rid of this plant because they consider this is a weed. And I said, well, you guys don't know the value of this because this plant is being lost in certain cultures, and they're trying to revitalize this. So a lot of interesting things are happening, and I think there is also a need for oral historians to really engage into cross-fertilization of ideas across different cultures in community. And so, as I said, food is not. I share this idea. This is. If you look at this table, look at the grains on the left, and look at the protein, like rice, wheat, maize, and at the end in the yellow, all the millets, some of the traditional grains. Look at the protein, crude fiber value, energy value, iron values, as opposed to rice and wheat. So very, very highly nutritious grain. But why we are losing it, I don't know. But that's something I think we should really start oral history research, which really means something to people, which really is important issue for the world, not, you know, just for us as an academic. We also started school competitions. So what, and this is another way to enhance the intergenerational transmission. So we asked children to go and talk to elders. We give them 2 weeks and document. So students have become local oral historian. They would go and talk to elders. They will write their stories. And on a particular day, everybody get together in the school. They come and share the stories. And we found that this was a very amazing experience to really tell students that there is a knowledge in their own community, which is also very important. And this really helped revalorize some of their traditional knowledge systems. Some of the schools, after we left, some of the schools have been doing this for so many years now on their own, because they found that students have really found an opportunity to reconnect with the community on something meaningful with their lives. They found that culture is not something which is portrayed as bad by outsider. There are certain very good traditions in the culture, their own knowledge system in the culture, and that they should build upon. So there's some fascinating pictures. We also did some drawing competitions, basically trying to revitalize some of the food and medicine-related oral history in their own cultures. There's also another idea that we tried is called recipe contest on wild foods and traditional foods. So what we do is we go to those villages and we ask women folks to bring out and make recipes which they no longer make it because they have been forgotten, either because of our dietary preferences have changed, our taste habits have been acquired very differently, because McDonald's and all those restaurants are telling us that this is the only food that we should be eating. We thought that this is a fantastic idea because, you know, recipe contest, they bring some traditional food, forgotten food. And when we have a community feast of this traditional food, some of the community leaders, they thought, well, this is great. Well, where did this food go? And I said, well, that's the question that you should ask yourself. And to my surprise, that some of these villages are now building upon this recipe contest and trying to revive some of the forgotten recipes. And indirectly, they are trying to revive their forgotten food in many ways. So this is a book that you're looking at. It has some, you know, Canadian dietitian guideline as well. And we launched this book last year. Somebody from University of Winnipeg recently approached me. And they are going to use this book as a teacher resource in many First Nations schools in Manitoba. So I think that's a good sign. There's something happening, oral history in action, and that's what I would like to see, actually. And I think I'll just end here. I'll just end here with the quote from one of the nurse, but also an elder from Fish River. And I'll just leave it there. And I'll also leave it where I'm still struggling with this question. And please help me try to find an answer. Oral history for whom? I'll just stop here.